My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't live in Venice Beach. Venice Beach is where all the freaks are in California. I couldn't make it there. I live inland with the lawns and trees and cat burglars. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say, because I didn't used to be. We had a very nice trip out here, all in all. We had a very good time. I want to especially thank Pedro and Caron, who came and met us at the airport. And no applause, just a simple nod will do. And I want to thank them very much. And incidentally, shouldn't tell you this, but today is Caron's birthday. Happy birthday, Caron. You don't have to clap, it's just a natal birthday. It means nothing. And I'd like to congratulate the new lady who got her book tonight. It says something for AA when someone 2 days sober looks better than the speaker with 46 years old. Stick around, you'll get old too. I want to thank Mary R. for an excellent tour of all the mansions in Palm Beach today. I saw more mansions than I knew existed. When I was a boy in the Lutheran church, it said, "In my father's house are many mansions." They must have been talking about Palm Beach. It's been a good trip. Well, I have had some bad trips, but this is a good trip. A few years ago, I had kind of a bad trip. Always sticks in my memory. I went off to speak in Iceland, in what's the name of that city? Reykjavik, Iceland, which is way beyond any length, of course. And on the way back, it's a long trip on the way back, and you get tired. You take Air Iceland, which is really you say to the stewardess, "Can't you go any faster?" She says, "Yeah, but I got to stick with the plane." And you get to Minneapolis. I had about a 4-hour wait in Minneapolis, a tired Sunday night. I had to go to work the next morning, sitting there waiting for the United airplane, and went to the red carpet room, which is the United Airlines frequent flyer room in Minneapolis, and sat there, and eventually read, and had to go to the can, and went to their washroom, lovely little washroom, nice little clean little room, and two little stalls side by side, and with little doors, and I sat in my little stall and thought about things. And all of a sudden, out of the other stall, this voice says, "Hi there." I just ignored it. Pretty soon the voice said, "What are you doing tonight?" And I thought, I better get this settled right now. So I said, "I'm going back to Los Angeles to see my wife and my children and my great-grandchildren and my grandchildren. And thank you very much for asking. It's very nice of you, but I'm well taken care of. Thank you." I thought, that should do it. There was a long pause, and a voice said, "We could really have some fun tonight if you wanted to." And I was tired, and I overreacted. I wasn't a good old-timer that day. I said, "I don't look, pal. I don't know what your problem is, but I'm just trying to in here to do something I need to do, and why don't you do the same thing, and why don't you just shut up for a while?" There was a long pause, and the boy said, "I'll have to call you back. This asshole in the next stall won't shut up." That's what you call a bad trip. I know we have a lot of people here tonight who are visiting or haven't been AA very long. I noticed the back row, there's a lot of people, I think, from the local treatment facility, plus some other people. And you may wonder what the big deal is about staying sober and why we make such a big deal about it. And I'll tell you, it's because that it isn't anywhere near as common as you might think. You know, there seems to be types of alcoholics. Nobody ever seems to talk about it much. Bill refers to them in the book. There seems to be a type of alcoholic that's an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink, they've lost control, apparently. But something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose a job, or maybe they lose a family, or there's a death in the family or something. And they quit! And they never drink again. And they're often held up for examples to people like us. Why can't you be like who used to drink too but stopped drinking? There are some of these people who have also become physically addicted to alcohol, which you may think doesn't mean much, but the withdrawal from physical addiction to alcohol is more lethal than the withdrawal from drugs by far. They are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to be medically withdraw alcoholics step by step. Each step of the way, they show them the nature of the problem, explain why they have to stop. And by the time they're ready to go out, they've learned their lesson. And they quit! And they never drink again. In fact, up in Seattle, there's a very big hospital called Chic Chadel. And they've advertised, we will cure your alcoholism within 30 days, including follow-up visits. And they have a long list of names of people who have successfully done so, of this type of alcoholic. Then there's another type of alcoholic that seems to be an alcoholic by the way you measure them. They drink, seem to have lost control. Something happens that really threatens their security. They lose a job or they lose a family or somebody dies in the family. And they quit! But they always eventually begin to drink again, sooner or later. And these same people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. And they quit! But they always begin to drink again. And these are the people that have baffled humanity for the last 4,000 years, written records of people like this who just, at one time they thought they were possessed by devils. There's no explanation for their conduct. They put them to death. They flog them and put them in jails and send them away. And England would transmit them to Australian colonies. Just endless, endless. They went to Georgia a lot of them. I'm not judging people in Georgia. I'm just telling you that's where they went. And if you stay around Georgia very long, you'll know it. Yeah, I'm first family of Georgia. But even up until my lifetime, there's never been an answer to these people. There's never been an answer. And these are the people that are just baffle everyone. They baffle ministers try to help them, and doctors try to help them, and families try to help. If anybody here, if you're an alcoholic like me, I'm sure you are if you're in this room, What you'll see, my reaction to it, and probably where you see it, is this: that look on the face of people who love you, and they look that terrible look again. Oh, how could you? You said you wouldn't. You promised, and now look at you. You're worse than ever, and the children you were doing better. How could you do such a thing? And there's no known answer to that except leave me alone. Leave me alone. Get off my back. Because I understand it either. And these are the people that cannot stay sober. And oddly enough, those are the people who wind up in these rooms, who are noted because for 4,000 years people like us can't stay sober. And it's just a miracle, and the only problem is we have a tendency to forget it. You know, it's an interesting thing. You know, for 4,000 years they've been battling alcoholism of our type. Only in the last 70 years, and at first there was hardly any exposure to it, just very few, but has there been any numbers of people who are staying sober? And you and I, through no merit of our own, have been born in the only window in the history of mankind where there's a place for... What's wrong with this mic?
You're touching it.
I couldn't help myself. I'm sorry. Now you know my problem. Is he looking? But we live in the only window in the history of mankind where there's a place like people like us to go and get sober. And the greatest enemy we have to fight here is to take it for granted and not do the things that keep us sober. Isn't that amazing? The streets are full of people who used to be successful in AA. Some of them try to get back and can't. Some of them die. Here's an interesting thing. According to, I guess, the most recent figures, as far as I know, late 19 or 2002 from the National Institute of Health, it is estimated of alcoholics of our type in America, which is the heartbeat of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. More sober people in America than ever was anywhere. And there are 840 countries now. But in America, which is the heartbeat, it's estimated that something over 90% of alcoholics of our type still die drunk, or as a direct result of drinking. I think it's safe to say a number of people in this room will die drunk. Long, hard deaths. I'm not trying to scare you at all, but I mean, it might be me, might be you. I remember my sponsor told me that. And I thought, what a dismal recruiting talk. But some years later, when he died drunk, he put an exclamation point on it, because in his day, he was as good an A as I knew. But he somehow drifted away. And when you drift away from here, because it turns out there's a kind of a misunderstanding, I think, about alcoholism. And that is that if you do bad things, you'll get drunk. And that isn't true. I've known bank robbers who stayed sober. I've known terrible people who stayed sober. And good people who haven't. Why is that? Because it isn't bad things that get you drunk. It's the failure to do the things that keep you sober. We're talking about that this afternoon. In one of the North Hollywood Club some years ago, Secret Service came in and took three guys out of the front row. And it turned out they had a long chain of bank robberies. And people, how could they stay sober? You know how they stayed sober? They went to meetings and helped newcomers. You know, they probably weren't terribly comfortable at night, but I mean, they could stay sober.
They robbed banks and gave the money to the newcomers.
Huh?
They robbed banks and gave the money to the newcomers.
This is the signal for group participation. He's going on a cruise tomorrow. He doesn't care. But it's kind of funny to think about talking about the heartbeat of AA. You know, it seems generally accepted that Southern California is really the heartbeat of AA in America. There are more sober alcoholics south of Santa Barbara than there are in New York and Illinois combined. It really is a remarkable thing. There are over 3,000 meetings in our meeting list in Los Angeles now. And there are still people who think Akron is the heartbeat of AA. Akron has the same relationship to AA that Bethlehem has to Christianity. Something nice happened there once, but not for a long time. But I'm in a situation today where I see people like us die and go mad and have terrible lives, and people like us and people also advanced narcotics addicts. Until we moved recently, when I go to work in the morning, I leave my house out by West Los Angeles, which is out by the ocean, and I can drive downtown on the freeway and park in my parking lot, then step over the bodies of men and women and children dying of alcoholism and drug addiction to get to my office, work all day, see what we can do to we're not a treatment center, way below that. We try to keep them alive and go home and step over the bodies of dying men, women, and children. And you think, how horrible. But it really isn't horrible, because nothing is horrible after you're used to it. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. Nothing is horrible after you're used to it. That's one of the stories I think about sometimes, is that it's hard to explain sometimes to new people when they finally get a hold of the program that it isn't going to be all bed and all roses. Get these calls sometimes when they say the magic word that just sends a shiver down your spine. They say that, "Hi, I want to talk to you about my new relationship." You just hope you have an aha machine on your desk and put the phone on that and walk away. Oh, I know this is the one, I swear to God. I know I thought the last girl was this, but God, when I saw this girl walking out of detox, you hate to have to tell him the truth, you know. This is not going to last, pal. I mean, this is alcoholic infatuation. You know, it's not going to last, but they just know, no, this is going to be the one. Then you have to, well, we were having lunch today, and we both reached for the salt, and our fingers touched, and I saw a spark. I swear to God, there was a spark. Really? That's interesting. You have to hate to tell them the truth, you know. Look, pal, this isn't going to last. In the 1 in a billion chance that you and she have a successful relationship, and maybe we'll say you'll get married later on, And maybe in 3 years you'll have a little bungalow with a little white fence and maybe a toddler playing in the front yard. And you'll be having lunch with your darling. And you'll be sitting at the table and you'll reach for the salt and your fingers will touch and you'll say, "Give me the goddamn salt." That's the way it goes. But nothing is really wonderful. But I see a lot of people. It isn't really horrible because I've seen it for so long. I was going to go down there and do it for a couple of months many years ago, and now I've been down there 31 years. I don't know what the hell kept me there. But when I first went there, I was full of zeal. I was going to help these people and get sober. I know a way to get sober, and I'm 15 years sober, and I'm going to show you how to do it. It's going to be great. And one after another, very few responses. I think, what is the wrong with these people? I got a message for them, and they don't want to hear it. Then I just suddenly remember, if Alcoholics Anonymous could be transmitted by good intentions, why did I drink? Why did I slip year after 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 year? The worst years of my life came after I was acquainted with Alcoholics Anonymous and going to meetings and good people trying to help me. And then I went through started as a high bottom drunk, kind of, and it worked out through a medium bottom drunk. And the last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission and said, "Then stay out of here, you damn mooch." I tried to explain to him, "I'm not a damn mooch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the old L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and New Yorker, Sharing Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside that damn old mission on a cold, rainy, sick morning, and so I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now because I've seen other people have it. But it's the feeling of suddenly realizing there's no friendly direction. There's no direction to go that's going to be better than any other direction. There's nobody out there glad to see me anymore. And I stood there in the rain, and if some old guy had come up to me that morning and said, "You know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120 some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost all your clothing, all your identification. Remember when you lost that car you were supposed to drive from Dallas to Los Angeles? You got drunk in Phoenix and lost it. Now you never did find it. Wait till I get to the part where I get cancer and die. You'll love that." "Pedro, why don't you get the car started? I'll be out." He said, "That's the night that you got in a fight in the street corner with the policeman and they threw you in jail overnight. And that's the night you vomited on somebody's bunk and he got so mad he kicked all your teeth out, your front teeth. That's why you have no teeth. That's why your mouth is standing. You're bleeding down on your shirt." He might have said, "You're an only child. Your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather's so tired of watching you play on her emotions till she'll go down to a little tiny bank account, take out a few more dollars and send it to her little boy and think that'll help him. And you'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are." And he might have said, "You know, you've been going to AA for 10 years now, sitting in meetings and smirking and hitting the meat till the heat is off and pretending to be interested in sobriety. And you just laugh and joke at these idiots and make fun of them. So go back to bars again. We talk about them, how ridiculous they are. And now you're dying." He said, "What if he said, if you'd go back, why don't you go back to A one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and see what happens?" And if someone had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, which I may or may not have been, but I have to say, "Pal, you don't understand. It's not the way it looks. I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. My life would have been so much better, but I'm not." And he might as well prove you're not an alcoholic. I couldn't have done that. I wouldn't have had the objectivity to stand back and delineate the differences. So I probably would have to do what guys like me do when we get cornered and we get afraid. And we take defense behind bluster and say things like, "Get away from me, you son of a bitch. I'll crack you. Leave me alone. Get out of here." So I'd want him to get him close enough to know that I'm afraid. But I, if I would could have, I would have told him, I know, I don't get to, I'm not an alcoholic. Based on sitting in these meetings for 10 years off and on all over the country and listening to these alcoholics talk, and I'm not like that. Now, we have a whole bunch of new people back there. You know what alcoholics are. I learned that my first week, when I first went to AA. Alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol, and they have to learn to accept their problem as alcohol and come to Alcoholics and admit it, and then they return to God and get some new values, and then they show their gratitude by helping others. And that doesn't work for people like me, because my problem really isn't alcohol. And I, for one, because having been raised in the strict, strict Norwegian Lutheran Church, maybe in some religions their God is a little softer, but ours is not. And I have broken all 10 commandments, and there's no way to go back. You can't go back then. And I don't know that I'll have enough gratitude to help anybody, because I just feel put upon all the time. I wish my problem were alcohol. I wish that was simple like these people who donate. Or I remember people talk about how they stop drinking and their life improves. And some of them say they couldn't stop at all. But I always have been able to stop. I've quit so many times. And my problem is not that I can't quit and not that I can't resolve to do better. But it seems like sooner or later somebody sneaks into my bedroom in the middle of the night and puts an invisible spring in my gut sooner or later. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as anything. It's just a little growing restlessness. Just a little irritability. Just a little getting tired of getting these sermons from people who are living off my abilities. Just a little tired of being treated like a second-class person because I had a few drinks. Just a little tired of all this crap. A little tired of this job now. A little tired. My kids are making a little too much noise. And it gets pretty bad. And I've tried a lot of things with it. I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis over a period of time. I read books. I went to meetings of weird people sitting in the back porches where they thought they had answers to things. I did a lot of things. But I'll tell you what stops that feeling. Two or three drinks. That's all. That's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. And I take those drinks. And then sometimes I drink too much again. And they say, see, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? You have to say, yeah, I guess it was. I guess you were right. But inside of me, a voice just wants to shriek, but you don't understand. That's not my problem. There's something wrong inside me. There's something inside me that's missing. I don't know what the hell it is. I've noticed it since I was a little boy. But I don't know what it is, but I know when I get close to people, they seem to recognize there's something missing in me. They don't seem to like me as well as they do at a distance. And I don't seem to fit into groups very well. And when I'm around people I want to look good to, and I feel awkward, and the people I want to like to run with, the class above me, I feel clumsy, and the people that think I'm all right are not the people I want to be with. And I don't seem to make small talk as well as a lot of people do, and a lot of things. And I discovered as a boy that when I was 15 years old on a ship in Pearl Harbor, run away from home, that when they got me to try a drink of whiskey that I finally held down, it changed that. I guess the thing was always this. If you're supposed to feel like this in life, kind of inside, for some reason or other, I always mostly felt like this. For always different reasons. I studied them a lot. I didn't know what to do with them. And what alcohol does for me, it gets rid of the scale. It may be temporary, but I feel, that's the only time I feel the way men look. And when I'm not that way, I'm putting up a front. And that's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. And stopping drinking does for me just makes, there's the scale again. And there's all the thoughts and all the memories and all the what it might have been and all the despairs and all the criticisms and all the problems. And maybe this time I won't drink quite so much. And drinking is the best. If you're new tonight, I'll tell you something that may sound shocking in an AA meeting. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had. I've never had a better friend than alcohol. Friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Jobs come and go. Cities come and go. States come and go. But a few drinks, wherever you are, if that can bring about this change, it's the best thing I ever found. And my only problem is, how can I keep from doing it too much? How can I can't do without it? You say you can stop if you want to stop, bad enough. I stopped once and I gave it all I got. I was in jail overnight once. I was in jail overnight several times because I have a terrible weakness. When I get to a certain level of drinking, it is necessary for me to counsel police officers and tell them they're blue-belly snots who shouldn't be allowed out on the streets. And so I've gone to jail overnight several times, and after a while you get used to it. I get out in time to take a shower and go to work, you know. This one morning I got out and somebody said, boy, you should have stayed home last night because your little son died and we couldn't find you. And I had four little girls and a little boy, and it just about killed me. Oh, my God. I felt so bad about that. I just couldn't stand it because he was going to be my heir. I remember sitting around on Sunday. I went back to Wisconsin, sitting around in the living room with my wife's father and her two brothers, big farmer guys, good old guys. They all treated me so well. Here, Clancy, have some coffee. Here, have some pastry, Clancy. Must be a tough time for you. But in their eyes, you could just see, you dirty bastard. You dirty bastard. You did this to our sister. Oh, here, have some coffee. And the next day when we buried him, I put my hand in his casket. Nobody's looking. I said, John Emsland, this will never happen again. I am so sorry. It's going to be a better life for your sisters. And I went back to Texas where I was working, and it was almost like an Easter thing. You know, someone had died, but it had a great effect. We were all going to do better. But my kids and I started doing things together, and I'm feeling good, and I felt like I should do more. We all missed and loved John, but we all were together and go for rides, and oh, great. And it just ideal. Except after 2 or 3 weeks, somebody sneaked into my bedroom one night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And then it began to change. Just a little growing resentment, nervousness. And now in addition to all the other things, I had a new campaign against God, who would kill my little sinless son to punish me because I'm a sinner. What kind of a God would kill a little boy to, even though the father was a dirty, rotten, bad guy? How could he do it? And he gave me less God. God, I hope you. And it just got worse and worse, and the pressure mounted. And pretty soon I didn't like that town anymore. I didn't like that job. And my kids, who I was doing it for, their noise would make me, Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. Please, for Christ's sake. Then hate myself for me. I'm sorry, we'll play tomorrow. And I couldn't stand it. One day my wife took the kids to church, and I came home and pulled the car in the garage and hooked up a hose in the exhaust pipe and shut the door, turned the motor on, went to sleep and died. I just didn't know what to do. And fortunately, some guy next door was sitting in his breakfast nook having a cup of coffee, saw me go in there and heard the motor running, and I didn't come out, so he ambled over to see what was wrong, found me dead in the car, and pulled me out and beat at my chest, breathed my mouth. They rushed me to the hospital, oxygenated me, studied me for a while, determined I was seriously mentally ill, and committed me for an indefinite period to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. That's how I get when I get sober. That is not something I want. I must say, though, I was there about 2 weeks, and my strength came back, and I thought, Jesus, what am I doing in an insane asylum? And so it took me about another week to find a way to get out of there. I found a way to get down a corridor and through a door and across a yard and over a fence, and I was gone. But I didn't know that. I don't know if you've ever been in West Texas. But after you get over the wall, you suddenly realize they can see you running for 3 days out there. It's just a matter of time. You're up in your white bathrobe. Just. Why, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. They snatched me back and gave me 2 or 3 months of electric shock treatments for that run. And I didn't run anymore, I'll tell you. When you take 2 or 3 months of electric shock treatments, you just stand there. What's your name, boy? I don't know. They know at the desk. And I might never gotten out of there, except the next year, the next spring, they put in an alcoholic ward. First one in the state of Texas, a pilot study. And my sense had come back by then, most of it. I was in a kind of a senile ward with old people because I was no longer in danger, they felt. And Mr. Ross apparently had set up a ward in the other hut. I thought, if I can get that guy, I'll get out of here. And I made a point. I was a hospital mailman by this time. I made a point of stopping and seeing him. I said, Mr. Ross, I put on my best newcomer look. I'm here on a suicide commitment from El Paso. I was on the college faculty there, and I don't know how to explain this to you, sir, but I've always had this trouble with drinking. It makes me drink too much, and I don't stop, and I obsess over it. I'm sober. And do you have any kind of a book I could read, or are there any kind of meetings or things you could help me with? God, his eyes went... He had never seen a sincere newcomer before. All the people were in there. The practice at the hospital at that time was in Texas. They'd tried a law where you could commit somebody in your family, a known alcoholic. They'd have to go to this hospital for 30 days and stay there no matter what. And so nobody was in there sincere. They're just, what are you going to do to get out of here, Fred? I'm going to kill that bitch. I went to the ward there, and I was the best one they ever had, because I knew what they wanted, and I gave it to them in spades. And eventually I got to be secretary of the group. Eventually I was, they used to send me out to give little talks around the area to show the wonderful work AA was doing. Two of the hospital guys would take me like over to one of the nearby towns, Midland or Odessa. I'd give my little talk. Hi. I'm here on behalf of my fellow patients at Big Spring State Hospital. And I want to thank each and every one of you for bringing meetings and messages to us in our despair. It's as though we were going across a vast desert of alcoholism. And we came to the tall green hills of sobriety, but they were too steep for our weary legs. But folks, people such as you pointed out 12 golden stairs that we could climb one at a time until we got to the height of this wonderful hill. Now, as we start to reach the hill of sobriety at the top, we're going back to our homes throughout Texas. We're looking for other lost people in that desert, and it's all because we can show them over here, there's a way to go. And it's because of people like you. May God bless you. And you can laugh, but God be out of the Texas nut house. And I never had another drink till I ran out of Thorazine. That's how I get it. Stopping drinking has no incentive to me. It makes whatever reality is impossible. But I stood in that street corner. Nobody came up to me. Nobody talked to me. I look so terrible. I got torn clothes on. My vomit on me and blood and nothing else. No front teeth. Drank, unshaven. There's only one place in the world you can go and you look like that. That's an AA club. And they're, oh, look, there's a newcomer, Fred. You know. I said, where's the nearest AA club? I said, well, it's Wilshire and Fairfax, quite a ways from here. Wilshire, you have to walk up this hill to Hill Street, then walk over to Wilshire, then walk west till you can you find it. I still walked up that hill and walked west. I still remember vaguely walking up that street, Wilshire Boulevard, all this luxury and drunk and crazy bastard walking up the street in the rain, people in cars going by and pointing and laughing. And I counted later in my car about 6 miles, 6-7 miles, long walk. But I got to this club, and it's the same old crap you get in every club. There's the 12 steps, and there it is. You really have to go, miss. Nick of time. Anyway, and they say, well, live and let God do it, and all these things in Jesus. And some old goof said, hi, welcome to AA, son. You're home now. Thank you, I believe I am. I lurked around there, and that night they had a meeting, and they had about some cake. I had about 4 pounds of cake, because I could chew that. And they had a meeting on gratitude, and I almost puked it up. And just, oh, man, these simpletons. How do they know how lucky they are not being forced to have to think? Just, I'm an alcoholic. And the next day I lurked around there, and there was another meeting that night. And went to that, and it kept raining. I was waiting for it to stop raining so I could get out of there. And you were supposed to be a member of the club to go in during the daytime. You could go to the meetings at night. The manager of the club took mercy on me. He said, you know, you're such a mess, you know, you need the cake, I guess, but you can come in here in the daytime. But I don't want you asking anybody for money, and no swearing or cursing or profanity. Okay, thank you. And this went on for days. I just drank. Just listened to this crap. And I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe my sins have caught up with me at last. Maybe hell is not fire and brimstone like you think. Maybe it's just being cold and sick and you hurt all over. And you look at people who have contempt for you. And somebody talks to you about AA every day. Can you imagine this for eternity? And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be. Had no intention for it to be. And what happened, what's, of all the things that saved me, sitting in those meetings, I've thought about this many times to look back. In a couple of the meetings, I saw a movie actor. I'd seen him in the movies. He was a character actor. But I didn't know later that he was just a second-rate character. And probably the only two movies he was ever in. I've been in a lot more movies in the last few years than he ever was in, with better parts even. Movie actor. And movie actor said to me, rich and famous. Maybe that man needs someone to share his fame and fortune with him. And so I began sucking around him a little bit. And about after a week or so, they always do in these rabid AA clubs. Time to get a sponsor. Better get a sponsor. You got a sponsor yet? So I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? He said, yeah, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. They said he wasn't a good actor, but he really was, because he pretended to be a nice guy at meetings. That took a lot of acting for him, it turned out. He tried to be a right-wing fascist AA pig, just the worst sort. Do this. Everything. Why am I taking this crap from this guy? Because he was my only meal ticket out of there, that's why. And I had a plan. I hate to even confess it, but I had a plan. I was going to get some money from this jerk. Get some teeth, get some clothes, go back to New York, say, yes, I know I had some problems drinking. I was been fired at Tracy Locks. It cost him two big accounts. I'm very sorry about that. But I've learned my lesson now and I'm sober. You see, my eyes are clear. They said, but if you could trust you, they'll say, and I'll say, I'll work for nothing till you believe you can trust me. Okay, and I'll work for nothing and I'll eat them up and I'll get a job and I'll make some big dough. And I'll come back to Los Angeles finally and I'll buy this AA club. And I'll burn it down. And I hope they're all in it having a club meeting that day so I can hear them scream in pain. And Bob was this tough guy, but I found out later he didn't like me. And I know why, because I don't want to brag, but I was the worst type of newcomer there is. And I know that because I've worked with a lot of people in the last few years, and I've had two or three guys like me, and I just want to take a gun just out of my desk and say, here's your answer. And what that type is someone who's been around AA year after year and knows all the answers, but keeps drinking. And everything you tell them, they already know. I know that, yeah. I remember Bob once, he almost went over the edge. I said, he'd give me about an hour of some conversation, something out of the book. I said, Bob, that really is interesting, pal, but I think you misquoted the book, didn't you? That makes your sponsor crazy, I'll tell you. But he tried to help me because he was a good AA. I heard him say something once that just boggled my mind. And he said, as long as you think your problem's alcohol, you're going to die drunk. I said, oh, now what? New Screen Actors Guild breakthrough there, Bob? And I said, I showed him later, Bob, what do you say things like that for? You just make people crazy. It doesn't make any sense. He said, it does make sense. The whole is the name of the game. I said, Bob, everybody knows the problem here is alcohol. That's why they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, he says it isn't. And what is it, Bob? Are we all psycho-cybernetic? Is that it? And he said, he got red around the gills, as he often did. He used to say to me sometimes, why do you talk like that? That's the only time I ever really missed my front teeth. But I wouldn't give them pleasure of gumming it, I'll tell you that. But he explained to me over a period of time, he said, kid, he said, you got to remember this. If you think you're, the problem here is not alcohol. For some people it is alcohol, but for people like us it isn't alcohol. Like, what does that mean? And he gave me a long talk on it. He said, the problem is something else. It's called alcoholism. I said, Bob, Jesus, don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than hell. Alcoholism. Oh, I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. And over a period of time, he gave me a long harangue off and on, and most of it went through me, but the one thing that stood in my mind always is letters of gold still today. He said, it boils down to this, kid. If your problem is alcohol, all you have to do, you clean up your act, you quit drinking, and you're okay. And I said, Jesus, Bob, that doesn't work. I know, I've tried that 100 times. He said, that's right. That's because your problem isn't alcohol. Your problem is alcoholism. And unfortunately for you and people like me, it looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye. But the difference primarily is this. If your problem is alcohol, you stop drinking, clean up your act, and you're home free. In this strange thing called alcoholism, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I know that feeling. That's the first time anybody told me that. I said, well, if that's the case, but people know alcohol is doing bad things, then why would they drink? He said, that's the whole point, kid. They don't know alcohol is doing bad things to them. They're not drinking because it's doing bad things to them. He said, alcoholics of our type have an unnatural reaction to alcohol. What do you think it is? I know what it is. You start drinking, you can't stop. It's just terrible. On and on. He said, no, that's podium talk. The unnatural effect of most people don't seem to realize this. Alcohol does something remarkably extra for me that it doesn't do for most people. But I have no way of knowing that because I have nothing compared against. I'll have it myself. He said, when I have a few drinks, perception changes almost instantly. When I take a few drinks, it changes my relationship to the world around me. When I have a few drinks, it makes me taller and more self-contained inside, and them smaller and less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He said, because it's just fantasy. It's in your head, kid. It's not working. And also, it eventually sets up this phenomenon of craving where you just keep drinking a lot. A lot of people do that. He says, there's never been an explanation for that. I can't explain it to you, but that's there. And no one's ever explained that yet to this day, the phenomenon of craving. I have an idea of what it is, at least for people like me. When I'm living in the gray or black and white and desperately curtailed existence, and I drink, and that's a few drinks, and the technicolor starts to come in, and I start to relax a little bit. Oh, boy. And you start to sag a little bit, it seems like. So you have another drink to hold it. You take another drink to hold it. You get to a point, you see these old guys so drunk they can't even walk, crying out, give me a drink, give me a drink. They don't want a drink. They're trying to hold it. And eventually you can't, of course, you go down, you get so drunk, you get sober again, no matter what your story is. I said, Jesus, Bob, that's happened to me so many times. I said, well, okay, now you're sober and you know better. Why would you drink now? He said, that's the other end of it, kid. And he had an explanation that I never did find in the book. It's hinted at in the book. Somebody gave me a tape of mine from when I was 3 years sober. I heard it. I wanted to listen to it and see what I sounded like without front teeth. I went a long time without front teeth. My sponsor made me pay for them myself. But I heard myself talking about something he had told me. And I hadn't talked about it for 30 years. But it's still as true as it ever was. He said, kid, well, people are born, they grow up, they face a lot of problems. They face conflicts. They face long-term problems you got to get through. You face nice things you learn. You learn bad things. You learn what hurts you, like what doesn't or doesn't hurt you. You learn to, you have to cope with things and work your deep, long problems through. He said, that problem is called maturing. That process is called maturing. And when you become a mature individual in this world, you live a pretty comfortable life. You don't do things that hurt you. Situations, we drink to get rid of it. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. And my closet gets filled with emotions that have never been dealt with. So now I'm sober. I'm grown up, and I'm sober. I'm going to change my life. By God, it's going to be different. I swear this time it's going to be different. I'm going to go back and get another job. I'll hold that job. I'll go to work on time every morning. I won't miss any time. I'll try to be a good guy, a good father. I'm going to straighten out. And my wishes are just to be right. And I never knew, ever. My sponsor pointed out to me, but I wouldn't have known it on my own in 10,000 years. All of these wishes, all of these aims, all of these goals are at the intermittent beck and call of childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions because it sounds a little nicer. Oh, I guess that's my alcoholism. What are alcoholic emotions? You hurt my feelings. I'm going to run away. I'm not going back there. I love you. Let's get married. And eventually he says these emotions become almost obsessive. And you got to get some relief. So you have a few drinks to ease off. And you drink till you have to get sober. And you stay sober till you have to drink. And you drink till you have to stay sober. And every time back and forth your head says, see, alcohol wasn't the problem at all. You have all these other things that people don't understand. Your case is different from them. You have needs. You're more sensitive, perhaps. You're a little more vulnerable, and on and on. And if you could just get things going your way, it wouldn't be necessary to drink so much. And people pursue that will-o'-the-wisp right into the grave. And you go to AA, and they talk about stopping drinking and make it better, and you have to say, I wish you did, but it doesn't. Maybe for you, pal, not for me. You don't even hear what's going on. I said, Jesus, Bob. That's my story exactly. I've never heard anybody talk about it like me. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, oh. What is it, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I thought, I'll be damned. I'm an alcoholic. For the last 10 years, I've been sitting. I've thrown away every opportunity, every chance I had. I had chances to be tremendously powerful people. Living in nice homes, living in, and all of it gone. I stand here in the street corner, my mouth bleeding, a bum, because I never could understand what my problem was. I said, Jesus, Bob, why doesn't AA explain alcoholism the way you just said, this obsession of the body, allergy of the body, whatever the hell it is, all that crap. He said, they do, kid. Look on the wall. Look at the one that says one. You have to admit you're lost your power to control alcohol. Then there's a dash, which means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And you've lost your power to control sobriety. I said, huh. I guess that was in January of 1959. And I've never had a strong desire to drink since then. And you may think, oh, his life turned out wonderfully. No, it didn't. Because I knew I was an alcoholic, but I was still a terrible person. I mean, dab attitude, sarcastic, that was my defense. I was sarcastic to people, being nasty. I'll tell you something else I learned in that period. Nobody likes to take crap from people without front teeth. That's what I grew up on. And my sponsor made me get jobs all the time. I get fired from my mouth and my attitude. And you say, well, why don't you think of drinking? I'll tell you, the best reason I can tell you is this. All those years I sat in those AA meetings all over the country, Chicago and San Francisco and Minneapolis, a lot of places where I was working. And I'd hear these mooches talk about their slips. Oh, I just came back from my slip. And it was just terrible. My brother had a slip and wrecked his car and died. Or I backed up over somebody and it was just terrible. It was just all these terrible stories. And I thought, I'm glad I'm not an alcoholic. Jesus, give me a drink. You know. But once I knew I was an alcoholic, I thought, God, if it was this bad, now what'll it be if I slip? It'll be terrible. So I gave myself permission to commit suicide, but not to drink. And two or three times I got good enough to almost over to drink, but never quite to suicide, thank God. And my sponsor, I got so desperate in pain, sometimes I'd talk to him and tell him the truth, something I never told my psychiatrist, never told anybody. Said, my weakness, I'm so weak, I'm just a phony. And what happened then, I guess, I look back and see this now, probably the greatest, one of the great things that ever happened in my sobriety, and nobody ever talks about it that I know of. I begin to slowly feel that my sponsor knew how I felt, which doesn't sound like much. Say that to Rotary Club, you'd laugh, so what? But I had never known anyone who I really thought knew how I felt. My dad didn't. He said he did, but he didn't. My minister didn't. My boss didn't. My doctor didn't. My psychiatrist. I know how you feel, Clancy. No, you don't. No, you don't. You think you do, but you don't. And what's so important about having someone who knows how you feel? If you're new, you might listen to this. I hope you find someone. All of us have had enough advice to last us 10,000 years. Everybody's had to. People like us just draw advice like flies. Just, here's what I think you ought to do. Thank you very much. You know. After a while, you just shine them off, let it bounce off the wall, the invisible wall, you know. But if you can find someone that you really believe knows how you feel, that advice becomes meaningful information from him or her. And that meaning of information, I may take actions doing, they're telling me to do things that I think is absolutely stupid, but the guy knows how I feel, maybe he's right. It's a remarkable thing. The trouble is, you know, then they, once they get you like that, they give you dumb things to do and dumber things. They don't actually say this ever, but it seems as strange as this. See that pulsar, son? That's bright red. No, Bob, it's kind of an off-white cream-colored tan, I'd say. I'll tell you, it's bright red. Looks cream-colored to me. Well, goddammit, you act like it's bright red. They don't tell you the color of walls. That'd be too simple to check out. They tell you things equally stupid. See that woman? I want you to apologize to her. Why, Bob? You called her a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. Sorry. Bitch. I want you to stay on that job till you get a better job. Jesus, Bob. They got me stuffing envelopes for $1.09 an hour. I used to have an office bigger than this company. And I, you know, this is terrible, Bob. I don't care. You stay on that job till you get a better one. You hear me? Understand you didn't go to the Thursday night meeting. Oh, Jesus, Bob. That's just a big cult meeting, an in-group. They all suck around each other, whiners and bitches. And they treat me like a piece of crap, Bob. Or maybe they know something. You go to that meeting. And this goes on and on and on. And embarrassment and humiliation. And one day you turn around and the damn wall is red. Then you have to spend the rest of your life dealing with dumbbells who think it's off gray. But really, I for the first time understood what they meant about action. Action is doing things that gradually change the way things are. It's amazing. The same things look different. And I finally held a job, and I was about 2 years sober, and I got a little job as a writer, finding a medical corporation. And I went to work every day. I was able to talk to my sponsor about how weak I was and how vulnerable, and he told me what to do. And over a period of time, I didn't have any front teeth still, but I learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people thought I'd been burned in the fire, you know. But I went to work every day. He was crazy about that. And I was 5 years sober. I was director of advertising for this medical corporation. I had teeth then. Smiled a lot. If there's anybody new in the back there who's short of teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually perfect, they grow back. I don't remember exactly how it happened. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world, and we all wore shiny suits and said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" And when I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, leaped out of their post office box, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. And all those kids have grown up. Three of them turned 16 this year, and three of my daughters. We had another little child who was a son, and he's 40 now. And all of my kids that are alcoholics are at AA, I guess. Only one of my daughters turned out bad. You know, I hate to talk about things like that, but she became a judge. She comes home at Christmas. She says, "Daddy, when we were little girls, remember how edgy you were and you used to send us to our room?" I said, "Sure, honey." She says, "When you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room." I don't take any speaking engagements in Albuquerque, you can let them know. And then I was, but I want to say one more thing for those in the back, kind of new, because this may or may not help you. But after I was sober a few weeks, I started on the steps, go through the steps, got to take the steps. And after I explained, I can't take the steps. I cannot return to God. I wish I could. I wish I could. But if God exists, I am damned. There's no question about that in my mind. They say, "Oh, that's just childish belief." I'll tell you, it's like Hitler said, "You give me their minds till they're 12 and they'll be Nazis as long as they live somewhere inside of there." And I knew that if God exists, I'm going to, Bob, I can't do it. I cannot return to God. He says, "It never says you return to God." Oh, to a power greater than myself. Does that fool the other boys and girls? Doesn't fool me. We know who they're talking about. He says, "Doesn't say that either. Read the damn thing. You come to believe in something. You come to believe in something. You don't go back to anything. Never in AA has ever said you go back to anything in your sickness. You come to believe in something. Can't you believe in God?" I said, "No, I can't, Bob." He says, "Can't you believe in AA?" I said, "Parts of it, but it's too religious. That all that religious, and I can't make that." He said, "Do you think I'm doing better than you are?" I said, "Of course you are, Bob." He says, "Congratulations. I'm your new higher power." And he became my higher power, and I could accept that. He could not send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. But I believed in him. And I began to do things he said, and little by little things began to change little by little. And I began to believe in what he said. And my terrible, terribly strong emotions, well, it's been such strong emotions, he was able to steer them. You know, if you kind of knew an example of that, a few years ago, I sponsored a guy who put the flag on the moon, the first flag on the moon. And he called me one day, he says, "You know, the Russians are having a convocation of astronauts at the Russian legation in France. And we're going to go over in the SST, and I'm supposed to bring a guest, but, you know, my wife and I are divorced, and the children aren't in America. Who could I possibly take?" And I thought, I'll sacrifice myself just for him. So we went over on the SST. You know, the SST doesn't run anymore. It's too bad. I don't know if you've ever been on it, but it was a long, narrow plane, two plush seats on each side of the aisle, and about 30 rows of them. In the front of here, there's a clock with one hand on it. And you take off, and the clock goes to about 3 o'clock, and you circle New York, get over the ocean, and then they turn it on. That arrow starts, goes all the way back to 12. Now you're at the speed of sound, 700 miles an hour, and it keeps going. And you're way up high. You can see the curvature of the earth. The sky is black. And when you land, you hope, "I hope we got good brakes on this sumbitch. We're going to be in Belgium or someplace." So. But what they really do, they land the same way we landed in Fort Lauderdale the other day. They just reverse the thrust of the jets. The same jets that push you this way, now they stop the plane. That's as simple as ever. And I've often thought about that. That's, in a sense, one of the great values of AA. AA, you can have emotions, strong emotions. Going to make you. It is absolutely essential that you drink. In fact, when people like us get in that mood, some doctors say it is, we drink to preserve our sanity. And it's necessary for me to drink. And what I can, if I can find it, to find someone who will, I'll give the power to reverse the thrust of that emotion and use those same emotions to get me to take actions I would never take in 100 years if I were feeling good. Do this! And little by little you get through it. That's why it's so necessary to have someone you can talk to that you can believe in. But I little by little did better. But the one thing I began thinking, because as much as I hate to admit it, most people like me want to find a reason for this. Mysteriousness is fine, but it isn't. And the reason, what does that mean? Come to, well, come to believe a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity. What the hell is sanity? You can read 10 mental health textbooks and get 10 different definitions of sanity. But oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. Psychosis. And really oversimplified, what psychosis is when the brain, under sufficient conflict, and cannot find an answer to the conflict, the pressure wells, and eventually in an effort to maintain its neural integrity, it will make a portion of reality look different than it is. That becomes psychosis. And sometimes it's all of it. Those people are easy to spot. They go to hospitals. But, you know, modular psychosis, these are the guys who, gee, I lived next door to that guy for 15 years, and all of a sudden he starts shooting people and shooting the family. What is psychosis? It is the ability, or not the ability, you don't choose to do it, but you change perception of reality. And once you do that, it stays that way. People today say things like, well, I was psychotic for a while, but if you're psychotic, you're going to stay psychotic. But here's the interesting thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. You say, but they say it's the next, second greatest cause of insanity. It is, but not from psychosis, from a different type of insanity. Anyone here who's ever been drunk knows how it feels to get up in the morning, you're on fire, you have to get something to put the fire out, something cold and wet. And the reason for that is because alcohol is probably the only fluid I know that dries out your body. It dries out your, goes into your blood, eventually kills the cells it comes in contact with. But when you drink fluids, the cells revive and they come back to life. There's only two organs in the body. When the cells die, they don't revive. One is your liver, one is your brain. And they've got millions of cells. You had a lot of drinking before it affects them enough. But eventually you can dry out enough cells in your brain so you can't function. This is ironic. What we call a wet brain is a dry brain. It's called the Korsakoff syndrome. And you think, well, maybe I've got that. Part of, not at all. If you've got it, you're not sitting anywhere in the world. You're sitting on a ward, and they come and change your diapers and feed you and put you to bed and get you up and feed you and change your diapers and put you to bed and get up and feed. This goes on, and you can never get better. If your body's healthy, you can stay like that for 50 years. And the families come down and see if Dad knows them or Mother knows them. Who the hell are you? Get out of here. They cry and go home. That's what alcoholic insanity is. Most of you will never see a case of it. I see it all the time, and it's a dreadful thing. But alcoholics don't become psychotic. Why not? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they drink alcohol. And drinking alcohol changes their perception of reality. We have the power without knowing it. I can induce temporary psychosis. Isn't that amazing? And we drink it, till you have to stop. So what I had to come to understand, for me, I had to come to believe there's a power here. And the great thing is this, newcomers, you have to believe in a power, but you don't have to understand how it's going to happen. You just have to believe it can happen, because it's happening to all these other people around you, all these old-timers here. It happened to them, so it's liable to happen to you. You don't have to understand why. That'll come long down the road. You have to try to admit there's a power greater than you somewhere that will enable you to live without having to induce temporary psychosis to stand it. Came to believe that a power greater than you will restore me to sanity, living in the world without having to drink or take medications to make reality different. And that was a great breakthrough for me. And of course, there's a third step, but I'm not going to talk any more steps than just that step. That's scary, because it says, came to believe that, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand it. What does that mean? I had to read that as saying, do what they say. Do what they say. Do what Bob says. That's turning your will and your life over as best I know. We don't mind you leaving, but leave the chair, for God's sake. This is a tough crowd, I'll tell you. But that's really what it boils down to. And when I was 15 years sober, AA changed my perceptions too much. And one day I found myself resigning a job in Beverly Hills where I was a big shot. The next day I was running this mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And for the last 31 years I've been the managing director of the Midnight Mission in the middle of Skid Row. And every day we watch people die, and every day we, once in a while, get somebody out of there and try to change them. But look, it's a great, it's been a great experience. I know there are probably some people think, well, how do I get to get a mission? Well, there's only so many missions to go around. I got mine, and just a fact of life. But I'll tell you, the one thing I learned in the early years that I've always believed in, I've worked with new people, I've done a lot of things, but action. You keep doing the things. The reason old-timers get drunk is not because age changes or because they change. They just stop doing the things that keep them sober. It's almost, it's just, it's such a, it's a great example of that. I mean, it still can change my life, and it's ridiculous. When I was about 5 years sober, I was doing pretty good. I was working at this medical corporation. I was director of advertising. Now I had teeth. I was active in AF. I bought time for me to become a secretary of the biggest group in this here town, baby. And the biggest group in town was the Brentwood Group, which met just four blocks from where O.J. didn't kill his wife. And so I, they had a system where the steering committee appointed the secretary. And I had a stooge on that steering committee. And I said, Smokey, bring up my name. See what happens. And I saw him the next day. I said, well, did I make it? He said, no, it died for lack of a second, actually. I realized there was not a groundswell. So I ground my teeth and pided my time. And somebody said, this little meeting hall over there called Ohio Street, the Tuesday night meeting just died. You know anybody who wants to take it over, start a meeting there? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And I took 12... my weary compatriots and went over there and rented this hall on Tuesday nights, $60 a month, something like that, and I got one of them to make coffee and one of them to do this and that. And I sat in my memory office. I was working in an advertising agency by that time, sitting downtown, and I wrote based on everything that helped me, I put a format together, and we had a meeting, and about 15 people came. And it was just wonderful. I gave some very good announcements. And, come back next week and bring a friend, won't you? And the next week we had about 22 people. And we're growing, baby. And apparently I offended somebody in my announcements. The next week we were down to 12 again. But little by little, I grew up to about 30, 35 after a year, 35 or 40. And I was feeling good. And I remember thinking, we're coming to our anniversary. Probably it would be a lot of groups would have an election now. But that really would be unfair to these people. They're new and they're still finding their way and they need guidance. And, oh, hell, I'll just sacrifice myself. So we didn't have an election. At the end of 2 years, we're getting about 60 or 65 people. And I thought, well, God, they're like an emerging third world country. They're so close to self-government, but not quite. Just... we just won't even bring up the election. Why make them worry about that? And a couple of months later, I was sitting in the kitchen in the meeting, and some boob came up whose life I had saved, I'm sorry to say. And he said, are we ever going to have an election in this group? I said, Jimmy, is there something wrong with the group? We're following the traditions. We're getting a good name around town. The drones are starting to hate us, so we know we're doing good. But he said, no, it isn't that at all. But people in other groups say you're a dictator. And if we had an election, elected you, nobody could say a word. I said, good idea, Jimmy. So we had an election, and they swept me out of office. I don't care. Forgot all about it. But I have the ballots home. I'm still checking handwriting. But to show you what a good job I'd done in building it, even after I left, it really took off. Now it's grown to the largest meeting in the world. 1,000 people every Wednesday night. Some of you have been there, the Pacific Group. It's famous all over the world. We send our tapes, our weekly tapes, to 120-some subscribers all over the world. And I'm not the secretary anymore, of course, but I'm the founder. And I sit in the middle and I give little signals. Nobody seems to pay any attention, but it makes me feel good. At the end of the meeting, people will bring newcomers over to me and say, this is Clancy. He's been sober almost 50 years. He started this group. He flies all over the world to talk to members of Alcoholics Anonymous. say, oh. And I say things like, glad you came tonight. Hope you brought your problems. Many folks leave them here. Once in a while, some puke will come up who doesn't know who I am. Hey, buddy, can you give me a ride back over to the VA psycho ward after the meeting? And the great thing about AA is you can think whatever you want. I can look right in his sick little eyes and say, what? Give you a ride back to the VA, you crazy bastard? You shouldn't even be out of there. There's 1,000 people in this room who need action desperately. There's one who was given all year after year after year. I'm not just some guy in a suit and tie. I'm Clancy I from up in the sky. Now you can think that as long as you say, okay. And after I drop the puke off the VA and I'm driving home, my head says, oh Clancy, is there no end to your goodness? But it's such an amazing thing that my life has changed. I knew all about AA and knew more about AA than the people helping me when I got sober. So it really boils down to this, you new people in the back. No matter how much you know or think you learn, it means absolutely nothing. And you can't get it out of the book, in my opinion, because the book is just information till you have experience that makes you say, oh, my God, that's true. That book gets smarter year after year after year. But I read it several times before I even got sober, and I thought it dull and pedantic, but after I was sober, I think it's the smartest damn book I ever read. I believe that today. And the purpose of AA, that's the last thing I'm talking about. The purpose of AA, what's the purpose of AA? Well, you're going to get sober, drier and drier and drier. Not at all. If that were true, I'd burst into flame up here. I really believe this with all my heart. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To little by little change my perception of the world, to little by little change my relationship to the world around me so I can live in some degree of peace, to little by little build me up a little inside and then make them less frightening and threatening to me so I have some degree of invulnerability, a tiny amount anyway. And that day is such a great moment in life when you start. And the bad thing about it is you take it for granted. You take it for granted, survive for granted. There isn't a person who's been sober long who doesn't know somebody who used to be around AA and gradually drifted off. Not because AA doesn't work, not because it's an unpleasant place, but I'm okay now. It's very similar to, I think in my mind's eye, to like diabetes, where they give you a regime to follow. You can't eat these foods, you can't eat these foods, you got to take your insulin. And after 5 years, say, hey, I've been feeling good for 5 years. I don't need that crap anymore. I'll eat what I want. I'm not going to take the insulin. And it sounds ridiculous, but that's what it boils down to. So you got to come here. Sit in the meetings. Simulate interest the days you don't have it. Listen to people. Talk to new people. And the last thing I thought you had to do, you had to show your gratitude by helping other people. That's wrong. You get gratitude by helping other people. That's what you do in days when you feel crappy. And our book says, when all else fails, you work with another guy or another girl. And in working with them and getting out of self, it starts to get better again and again. Because that's what it's about. All you have to do, you people in the back of the treatment center and this girl over here who used to be here but left with her book. Oh, she's standing in the doorway waiting to make her move. You sit down there. When I was your age, I was in the nut house. All you got to remember is this. Remember this. That you can't drink because you proved Russ you wouldn't be here. And without something, you can't stay sober because people like us are always going to have to drink. Somehow here, whatever it may be, there's a power of some kind in some way that you don't understand will enable you not to have to drink. And you have to find somebody and listen to them. It'll be worth everything it took. Thank you. Thank you.